This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Warming is accelerating along with increasing disasters. Can technology turn down the heat? Can climate change be reversed? The new book, The Long Heat, delves into carbon capture schemes and into minds unable to steer away from catastrophe. The book is from Radio EcoShock guest Wim Carton and well-known European human ecologist Andreas Malm. Both work at Lund University in Sweden. Andreas Malm authored more than 10 books, including Fossil Capital, The Rise of Steam Power and the Roots of Global Warming, and Overshoot, How the World Surrendered to Climate Breakdown. Let's talk about The Long Heat. From Sweden, Andreas Malm, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you so much, Alex. It's a pleasure and honor to be with you.
Why did you and Wim call your book The Long Heat?
Because this heat is going to stay with us for a very long time, it seems. And we're trying to map the front lines of climate landscape that we think will be in place for the foreseeable future. That is, we will have too much carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, so we will have very high temperatures, rising temperatures on Earth, and then the question is, how do we deal with this? And that's what we're trying to explore in this book.
Some Greens reject any form of geoengineering as unnatural and doomed because of our record of making things worse. Do you think that that is a mistake? Should progressives hold out hope for technical help in this damaged atmosphere?
Well, I think it's very important to be precise and concrete and not sweeping about these things. So there is no one position that can cover all technologies, but rather you have to study each and one of them and examine their merits. And I don't think we can reject solar geoengineering, if that's what you're referring to, out of a general opposition to technology as such. But I think that if you investigate this particular technological proposal, or proposed technology rather, you will conclude, or at least that's the conclusion that I would make, together with Wim, that this is a very bad idea indeed. Then there are certain technologies for carbon dioxide removal that might have some potential. We are in such dire straits that we cannot just write off all technological solutions a priori as, you know, by definition, flawed. We have to be very careful about this. That said, we argue very forcefully in the book that there's no way that we can get the climate crisis under any kind of minimal control without shutting down the fossil fuel industry and leaving fossil fuels in the ground. This is the alpha and omega. But because we have waited with doing this so long, we might also possibly have to use certain technologies for drawing down CO2 from the atmosphere.
So it's hard to picture just where we are on this climate escalator, I would call it. The German Meteorological Society and Stefan Rahmstorf accepted 1.5 degrees C is behind us, or at least no longer possible. But some American scientists are more conservative. They want to stick with the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change projections. Where are you on the 1.5 debate, and where are we in climate change?
I think we're flying past the 1.5 degree threshold very fast, faster than most scientists had expected. Last year was the first year when average temperatures on this planet were in excess of 1.5 degrees in comparison to the pre-industrial baseline. And I don't think it makes any sense to wait for two decades before concluding that this threshold has been passed. You know, there's this notion that the average has to exceed 1.5 degrees for about 20 years before you conclude that we've actually crossed this threshold. But the warming is now so fast that we might very well cross 2 degrees threshold too within 20 years. So that would mean that, you know, we would never have crossed the 1.5 degrees if we have to wait for 20 years until we can conclude that we have done so, which makes no sense now that the warming is so fast. So I think, yes, I think Rahmstorf is right in the sense that 1.5 degrees is now being breached. The question is, can we limit that breach so dramatically that we can retain a capacity to go back below 1.5? This is now the big question. And of course, the next limit that appears in view is 1.7 degrees and then 2 degrees. And the faster this goes and the higher the temperatures, of course, the greater the necessity of slamming a brake and shutting down the fossil fuel industry. This doesn't mean that the struggle is over, but it means that we have crossed the first extremely crucial line and missed the target of keeping capping global warming at 1.5 degrees. So this just increases the urgency, of course, of mitigation of climate action.
You know, I'm beginning to have less patience for the idea of transition, where we have a whole plan that's going to take 20 years, and meanwhile these disasters are becoming unbearable. So I'm wondering, is it too late really for transition? What we should be doing is going for a shutdown, going for a World War I, World War II kind of everyone together, let's change this whole system.
Yeah, well, this war analogy is a pretty old one in debates around transition. These analogies have been around for a long time, and people have imagined that once we, you know, hit the kind of crunch moment, something like a wartime mobilization will have to happen, and that this is what the transition would look like, where the state takes very strong command over the economy and shuts down the fossil fuel industry and the emission sources and shift the economy to another base. I still see that as a scenario, but it's evidently purely hypothetical and doesn't conform to any of the actual political trends that we're seeing in the key territories of the fossil economy in the global north. I mean, the US is going in exactly the opposite direction, and very much of the EU too. Where you can see, transitional trajectories are to some extent in Asia. The only country, I think, in the world that is engaging in an active transition, as in actually closing down fossil fuels and ramping up renewable energy production instead, is Colombia. That's the only fossil fuel producing country that has a government determined to phase out fossil fuel extraction from its economy. Although that government might come to an end next year when they have new elections in Colombia. But other than that very isolated case, we are extremely far from anything like a transitional program or a wartime mobilization, which doesn't mean, of course, that these things become any less necessary, but they seem perhaps even less close to realization than what they did 10 or 20 years ago, even though the urgency, of course, in the system is much larger now.
So in our technical fallback category, for a while there was some press and scientific support for marine cloud brightening as the solution to reduce overheating. Robot sailboats would shoot up salt or something. What happened to that?
Well, there are these moments of hype around different technologies. In the field of carbon dioxide removal, there was iron fertilization in the oceans for a while, and then that went completely bust. In solar geoengineering, yes, marine cloud brightening has had some kind of hype around it or buzz for a time. There have been limited experiments outside of Australia on the Great Barrier Reef. There was an experiment that was underway in the US, but it was stopped. But in the Department of Geoengineering, as distinct from carbon dioxide removal, it really is solar geoengineering, so sulfate aerosol injection, that is totally dominating the agenda, not marine cloud brightening as far as I can tell.
So we would reduce the amount of sunlight reaching the surface of the Earth. That might just affect our solar power, which is supposed to be the way out of a lot of this, and also our farm crops, which we need for a few billion people. I just don't see how anyone can argue that it'll be all right to reduce the amount of sunshine getting down here.
No, but the argument is made from a position of despair and desperation, if you will, where the argument is that, okay, it's too late, the heat is too high, and there's only one technology that we know of that has the capacity to slash temperatures to stop the process of heating and potentially even reverse it virtually from 1 year to the next, or even 1 month to the next. And that technology is sulfate aerosol injection. So you take airplanes and you send them out into the stratosphere and you shoot out soot to create a kind of a parasol or an umbrella or a shield around the sun that intercepts some of the incoming sunlight, block it, and thereby cool the earth. And I mean, that in and of itself is a pretty straightforward and strong case. What the advocates of geoengineering tone down are the enormous risks with the byproducts and with the side effects that keep being simulated and mapped by scientists in this field. It's very likely that geoengineering would wreak havoc in the climate system, some havoc that can be predicted, some that cannot, and that the end result would be various kinds of secondary and tertiary chaos in the climate system, including some of the side effects that you mentioned. So the case for geoengineering rests on the argument that when the climate crisis really explodes in our faces, which it is, you know, bound to do if we keep on treating it the way we do now, then we have to, there's only geoengineering that would allow us to manage it in the short term. You know, this case is strong, as I said, and there is an inbuilt logic here that makes it quite likely that at some point someone will try to do geoengineering, precisely for the reason that it's the only technology that has that capacity. But if someone tries to do it and deploys these planes, it's also extremely likely that you will see a whole series of side effects, you know, explosions, if you like, going off in the climate system in all sorts of places, and that it will not turn out anywhere near as well and orderly as the advocates of geoengineering imagine.
And there are a number of dead ends in geoengineering, like proposals to refreeze Arctic ice. Some of this stuff gets almost comical, Andreas, if we were not in such dire straits. Can you tell us about a dubious scheme that you cover in the book?
Yeah, there are many. You know, in the Department of Solar Geoengineering, you have utterly cranky, crazy ideas such as hitching the Earth to an asteroid and nudge it out of orbit away from the sun to reduce temperatures. This is not something that many have taken seriously, but there, you know, there's a whole spectrum of ideas covering the Sahara with plastic to reflect sunlight, placing objects somewhere between the Earth and the sun as a kind of a shade. Or in the field of carbon dioxide removal, you have similar far-out ideas, such as the idea that we describe in the book to hang lamps on the rainforests. The argument here, this was in a paper written by a couple of climate scientists the other year, the idea is that photosynthesis is naturally limited by nightfall. You don't have any photosynthetic production happening when it is dark. So if you produce artificial light, you can keep photosynthetic productivity happening around the clock, and this will draw down more carbon. So imagine illuminating the Amazon, for instance, during the whole night, and you would, according to these scientists' models, simulations, you would massively increase the drawdown of CO2 into the plants of that rainforest. The only problem then, of course, is that the entire rainforest and everything that lives in it is completely adapted to a diurnal cycle. So towards the end of that paper, these scientists would allude to the possibility that the entire ecosystem might come crashing down when all organisms are deprived of nightfall. Yeah, there is an idea that to speed up enhanced weathering, you can blow up the seabed with nuclear bombs to produce more surface for the weathering process. You know, everything. There's no shortage of imagination about when it comes to how to technologically interfere with the climate system. But virtually all of these schemes come with extreme hazards.
So you block the sun with your planes and my monsoons stop coming, so I shoot your planes down. Experts even study counter-geoengineering, like wars in the stratosphere. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so the case that you bring up here is one well-known potential side effect that sulfur aerosol injection might disrupt weather systems, including the monsoon on the Indian subcontinent that might collapse completely, and indeed, according to most model runs, will do so under any reasonable scenario of solar geoengineering. And then you have the scenario where the victims of such a side effect would have a strong material interest in stopping the solar geoengineering, so they could either attack the infrastructure or they could try to overtop the effect of solar geoengineering by, you know, maliciously releasing a lot of greenhouse gases to get the heat up again, or in some other way try to sabotage the ongoing process. So then there are all these speculations about what could happen then and what kind of conflicts could escalate and spiral in what direction. And one conclusion from this literature is that solar geoengineering is not going to work unless you have one power that wields some kind of monopoly on stratospheric violence or coercion, if you like. That is, there has to be one centralized sovereign ruler to avoid total chaos, someone who can stop counter-geoengineering and keep these conflicts under control, which is a scenario that lends itself towards quite authoritarian planetary structures, as many have pointed out.
Well, I would like to be the ruler of the stratosphere, but perhaps we can have an election for it.
Yeah, there have been people who have imagined that you could have indeed some kind of a democratic structure for governing geoengineering, or that you could do it through the UN, or that the IPCC could do something like this. There is a remarkable degree in this, in the pro-geoengineering literature, a remarkable degree of optimism about rational, peaceful, cooperative behavior in the governance of geoengineering. But this doesn't really seem to be the world that we're living in. And it also doesn't more particularly seem to be the world that has pushed us towards even considering this option. The world we're living in is the world of Donald Trump, and the world of his rivals, the Russian and the Chinese states, with their own authoritarian leaders. This is the actually existing world. So what you would need to imagine here is the weapon of geoengineering falling into the hands of someone like Donald Trump, and it's very likely that it's going to be the U.S. that does geoengineering, if anyone ever does it, for some obvious reasons. And will someone like Donald Trump, or whatever president succeeds him, in the trajectory that American politics is in, would someone like him deal in a rational and peaceful and generally cooperative fashion when doing geoengineering? I doubt it.
So you and Wim, in the book The Long Heat, you ask a question in the preface that still bothers me. And the question is, can we live with the crisis that was not stopped? What do you think? Can we?
I don't think we can have a straightforward answer to that question, because we don't know what the future holds. It's impossible to predict, and we're not in the business here in this book of giving simple answers to these questions. It's definitely too early, and in a way also too late, to just call it a day and say that we're doomed and we are staring at an inevitable apocalypse and we just need to learn to die. That's definitely not our position. But we also need a lucid realization of just how bad the situation is and how many uphill battles will need to be waged in the near future if we're going to save this planet in a livable state. And of course, all of this playing out in what I think clearly is a political climate that is degenerating incredibly fast, undergoing fascization, producing genocide, and veering towards ever more aggressive far-right politics in the Europe and the US, at least. And this is not conducive to climate action. To the contrary, it takes us ever farther away from it. So to make any progress here, we need to turn around some very major political trends, and that's not going to be easy.
I find it interesting we've been talking about politics and not the great shadows in the room, capital, the giant mega corporations and the billionaires who are making more and more power for themselves with less public view on it. Do you think we need an economic meltdown to save the natural world?
Well, I don't think there's any automaticity in the arrival of an economic meltdown or crash producing good effects for nature or, for that matter, working people around the world. I mean, if you look at the history of capitalism, most crises have rather been used by the capitalist class to unleash new waves of aggression against both nature and working people. So it depends entirely on how an economic crisis is dealt with politically. And if there is a new economic meltdown of the kind that we experienced, what is it now, almost 20 years ago in 2008, the outcomes for the climate, for the planet, for people at the bottom of the pyramid, the base of the pyramid, are totally determined by how a crisis is dealt with politically. And again, unfortunately, very often it's ruling class interests and nationalist politics that tend to capture the moment of economic crisis and take us even further away from progressive politics. So I don't think we can, you know, sit back and just hope that there was going to be an economic meltdown, because it's not on its own going to save us and might not even make things easier for us.
And yet the hope for natural disasters being some persuasion that would change the whole masses of humanity towards climate action, that doesn't seem to happen. We just get knocked over and then we suffer and then we go on again.
Yeah, and what's important to keep in mind here is that the bulk of the climate suffering that is happening in the world is happening far from the centers of capital accumulation. In the global south, in countries like Pakistan and Iran most recently, Pakistan perhaps most notably with the mass displacements that happened in Punjab a couple of months ago, more than 2 million people displaced by another season of extreme floods. This is one of the most vulnerable countries in the world, but it passes, you know, almost without notice, because our media is just so habituated to the destruction of the lives of brown and black people in the peripheries of this capitalist world order that no one raises an eyebrow in the core, in the center, when these kind of things happen. So the worst climate disasters strike the people that have done the least to cause it, such as very poor peasants in Pakistani Punjab. There's no like recursive process where that translates into progress on climate mitigation in the rich countries. And when you have climate disasters in rich countries, such as the fires in Los Angeles in January, there is, again, no suggestion there is some kind of causation or link between these disasters and sudden epiphany or cathartic insight about the state of the world and the idea that, okay, now we really have to do something about this. That's not what happened in the U.S. after the fires in Los Angeles. And there really seems to be a pattern where the far right that denies the climate crisis is getting stronger every year in the U.S. and in Europe. And the actual experiences of climate disasters do not seem to be able to slow down, let alone stop this trend, maybe even to the contrary.
Well, we can't let that go without a mention of your book, White Skin, Black Fuel, on the danger of fossil fascism. You suggest the rise of the far right can be understood as a reaction to the climate crisis, and that was in 2021. It seems almost prophetic now. Are you still thinking about all that?
Yeah, I am, but I'm not working on it myself. I'm working on a nerdy historical project that takes me deep down into history. But my comrades in the Setkin Collective are actively working on this, and they are preparing a second book that is forthcoming from Verso called The Great Driving Right Show, which focuses on the role of the car in far-right politics, and how the far right opposes any kind of climate action by posing as the defender of the car.
I just spoke to a scientist about 4.5 million years of history of sea level rise, and he was looking for a mirror in the past that would show us something about our future. Can we say that's part of your new project?
Yeah, what kind of history research I think should be related to present concerns. So when I'm writing, as I'm doing right now, environmental history of the early Middle Ages, I'm of course trying to see what is relevant there for what we are interested in now. That's how the most, I think, illuminating historical research works, which is not to say that there are any immediate lessons from what happened in, for instance, the 8th century in Europe to our situation now. It's not as direct as that. The strategic discussions about what needs to be done now will need to be much more, you know, focused on the current balance of forces in the world and the conjuncture we're facing.
From Sweden, we've been speaking with author and intellectual Andreas Malm about his new book with Wim Carton, The Long Heat, Climate Politics When It's Too Late. That's just out from Verso Books. You can find links to follow this whole discussion in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Andreas, thank you for sharing time with our listeners.
Thank you, Alex. Thank you so much.
We're out of time for this week. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening and caring about our world.
This is a climate emergency. Find out more on the blog. Ecoshock.org. No sign up, just the latest info, free for all. Ecoshock.org.
Just for depressing fun, you may want to follow Professor Elliot Jacobson on Blue Sky. He's a retired professor of mathematics and computer science. Elliot's been a casino consultant and wrote 3 books on casino games. Now he posts about the odds of compounding climate disasters, and he calls that the climate casino. He does not like our odds. Elliot is an unapologetic doomer. Last week, he reposted a global heat map generated through the U.S. NOAA service. The main site there says it is closed and will not be updated. But some of the data machinery and maps are still operating if you know where to find them. This latest map shows Earth is 1.9 degrees C hotter than the 1850 to 1900 IPCC pre-industrial baseline. It is already close to the much-feared 2-degree limit agreed to in Paris in 2015. Of course, that is just for one day, October 25th. There's a huge smear of red heat over many continents on this Earth, from Australia to the Arctic. That is how it starts. A few days here and there, over two, and then a week, and then a few years. 2024 was the first full year over 1.5 degrees C of warming. If we get a few years in a row, we are there, already in the danger zone. Find a link to Elliot Jacobson in my show blog. New science finds extreme weather and climate extremes are increasing in the Arctic. We just saw that when the remains of Typhoon Halong swept into western Alaska on October 12, 2025. The storm surge flooded villages 60 miles up the river. Some people were washed away in their homes. Giant Air Force jets airlifted survivors to safety. All this year and last, strange atmospheric rivers have traveled to the Arctic, where they were seldom seen, and they have been seen now deep in Antarctica. Just in case anybody wants to know.